Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We begin today with the fate of juvenile killers here in Massachusetts. The state has been slow to alter its policies despite a U.S. Supreme Court decision last spring banning mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole for the very young.
In its decision, the High Court deemed the mandatory sentences cruel and unusual punishment, which violated the Eighth Amendment. But it gave the states no specific guidance on how to apply the decision.
Other states, such as North Carolina and Iowa, have acted quickly to implement new laws reflecting the Supreme Court ruling. But that has yet to happen here in Massachusetts, which leaves victims' families, public defenders, prosecutors, and the offenders themselves in limbo.
Joining us now is Maggie Mulvihill. She's the co-director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting at Boston University. She wrote about this in today's Boston Globe. And Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, happy to be here.
So tell us how Massachusetts is trying to move forward on this ruling. I understand there are at least a couple of different views on how to go forward.
There's a lot of things developing in Massachusetts, in both legislatively and in the courts. There are cases of convicted juvenile killers which are pending in the Massachusetts courts, requests for new trial. There are juveniles who've been convicted, at least one juvenile who's been convicted of murder and has not yet been sentenced. The district attorney in Middlesex County is asking for clarification on how the Supreme Court ruling will apply in that case. There are groups of people meeting on new legislation that could be proposed in January about whether or not we keep this sentence at all. Gail Geringer, who's the state child advocate, and is Deval Patrick's key person on this issue, wants the sentence to be eradicated completely. So there's lots of different discussions going on about how do we deal with teenage killers. Mm.
And how many cases, Maggie, are affected by the Supreme Court ruling here in Massachusetts? How many cases are we talking about?
The State Public Defender's Office has identified about 80 individuals who could be affected. There's the people who are serving the sentence and have been serving the sentence for some time. There's 62 of those. There is at least one juvenile who's been convicted but not sentenced, a fellow named Marquise Brown. There are kids who've been charged with murder but not tried yet. There's a group of those who are appealing that are requesting relief, and some of them have begun to make Miller arguments. It isn't clear. I mean, part of the problem with quantifying this is it isn't clear whether or not this ruling is going to be applied retroactively to past cases. There's a lot of differing opinions on that, and courts around the country are ruling differently on that. So there's some hubris about how this is going to affect cases that are older.
Sure. And is there a reason, do you think, why Massachusetts has been slower than some other states to act on this ruling from the Supreme Court?
I think, honestly, that there's caution going forward, because the last time there was a major juvenile sentencing reform in Massachusetts, it was done very quickly, and some say in hysteria. It was in 1996 when the legislature passed a law that mandated that kids as young as 14, if convicted of first-degree murder, could be sentenced to life without parole. And that was action the legislature took after getting a lot of criticism from constituents because of the easier way that teenage killers were dealt with. If you remember the Eddie O'Brien case, he was the Somerville altar boy who killed his neighbor when he was 15. And there was a lot of controversy about how to treat him, whether to treat him as a juvenile, treat him as an adult. So the legislature moved very, very quickly, passed this law that the Supreme Court has now said is unconstitutional. And I think there's maybe cooler heads are prevailing. Maybe there's
moving forward with a little bit of caution.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about one more point. You write in your article that the ruling from the Supreme Court tore open a door that victims' families thought was locked forever. You've spoken with victims' families. How do they feel about this?
You know, there are victims' families that we included in the piece who don't believe, even though their own children have been murdered by at least one of the women we spoke to was a juvenile killer. They don't believe the kid should be locked up forever with no chance at redemption. And there are others that think that they're not they're not able to be rehabilitated. So there's a difference of opinion. I mean, the question is, these are people who once the killer was given mandatory life without parole, there was no way that the person could ever apply for parole. And now the Supreme Court ruling is turning that on its head and saying, yep, we might be able to go backwards and reopen this case. So they just don't know.
Sure. So a lot of folks in limbo. Well, fascinating story. We'll look forward to following it with you. Maggie Mulvihill is co-director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting at Boston University. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.